Hello, I'm Christopher Kassan, and this is Ireland's Edge. On today's episode, the unlikely marriage of AI and opera. Artists all around the world are trying to make sense of what the advance of artificial intelligence will mean for their creative work. Can the very human traits of passion and creativity survive in a world where we let ever more intelligent machines do the work for us? In Belfast, the innovative people behind production company Dumbworld have been thinking about this question in radical ways, integrating AI into their mission to bring opera to the masses. Brian Irvine and John McElduff brought a number of their street operas to Other Voices in Dingle, and at Ireland's Edge, they spoke with musician and cultural consultant Dermot McLaughlin.
My name is Dermot McLaughlin, and I'm delighted to have the chance to join in the conversation this afternoon with Brian Irvine and John McElduff from Dumbworld. And the frame for the conversation is really about an art form that many of us will know of and maybe have an uncertain relationship with. I'm speaking for myself here as well. And that's opera. And we're going to be talking about that in the framework of collaboration, the human interaction that happens, what opera can mean now and in the future. And we're also going to touch on the question of artificial intelligence and what role does that play or might it play in the future. One of the questions I've been asking myself when I've been doing my research for this is not so much is Dumbworld as a company ready for AI, but is AI ready for Dumbworld? And I think we'll have a very interesting chat about that. So to kick things off, it might be interesting, Brian, if I invite you to say a couple of words about how would you describe Dumbworld to the people in the room here?
Okay. So Dumbworld is a company that John and I set up. John, filmmaker, director, and composer. And we started Dumbworld as an attempt to explore the different connections between these formats. And we were driven by an idea of connecting with people and communities to create adventurous, dynamic art using film, theatre, music, whatever thing, anything that we could do. And so the only way we could really truly do it was to set up our own company, and it was a bit like a band in some ways, you know. Form a band, take on the world. that's what we tried to do.
No, that's exactly it, you know, and I suppose as it sort of grew and we got the chance to make more and more projects, we started to discover exactly what, you know, what we wanted to do, you know, and I think you hit on a really interesting point, and that was to collaborate with as many different people and groups and to make art in a way that was, yeah, that was as much about the meeting of people for the first time and exploring what we could do with that.
And Brian, as I was saying in my introductory comments as well, opera is often these days seen as an art form with which people have maybe complicated relationships.
Yes, yeah.
Or maybe incomplete understandings, if I can put it like that. I've heard people say opera is for everybody else, it's not for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, I agree with those people in many ways. And, you know, like my connection with music started off as a guitarist in a punk band, and I hated opera. And my relationship with opera isn't brilliant. I don't know much about all the standard opera formats. But as an arena, as a space to work, as a place where music, visuality, theatre, dynamic sounds, space, storytelling, ideas exist. It seemed to me we were attracted to the space that is opera, not necessarily the legacy that is opera, but the space and how we could reimagine that space, you know.
Yeah, I remember whenever we had our first commission to write an opera, and I'd never seen one before. And I thought, oh God, and I was saying to you, I was saying, what did I do? And you know, you were saying, well, have a look at this thing here. And I was like, okay. So the first opera that I ended up seeing was the one that we'd written and put on stage. And it's kind of been like that since as well, you know.
And But you see the collaborative nature of the work, as Brian said, it involves so many different disciplines and practices and skills. Mm. How do you get people to trust you?
That's a very good question, you know. But we're in a position now where for the majority of things that we start doing, we don't really know what we're doing. We make a couple of sort of steps forward and we start meeting people and talking to them. And I remember we did one particular project maybe about 10 years ago called The Oldest Woman in Limerick. And we were invited down to do a piece in Limerick. We didn't know anything about Limerick. We were two northern boys shipping in there looking for a fight. And so we decided the only way we can really do this is to start meeting people. So we set out on a quest to meet or to find the oldest woman in Limerick. And we started in a butcher shop in the center of town, and we asked the butcher, who's the oldest woman in Limerick? Do you know who it is? And he said, well, my mother is 93. You should go and visit her. And so we went and visited the mother, and she was furious. She was like, my neighbor's like 97. Well, I'm not, you know. And so she sent us next door, and then the neighbor sent us to someone else. And over a month or two, we moved around the whole city, meeting people, asking people for help and trying to find the oldest woman. And that, just that way, that brought people in. So whenever we went back and revisited everybody and we said, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to tell the story of the oldest woman we did find. She was 114. She'd spent half of her life in Italy, in Rome. You know, she'd seen Hitler and Mussolini go past her convent. And she told us her story, and so we were going to write a piece about her story. We went back to visit all of those people we'd met along the way, and we say, we're going to tell this story. Would you like to be in it and perform and tell that story? And the whole town then, or the people we'd met, joined us and told that story through music.
Yeah. And the example there then is come back to something Brian said about the excitement or the fascination of opera as the arena.
Yeah,
or almost a different lens for looking at things.
Yeah.
From the perspective of being a company, a production company, and an organisation, you obviously have to deal with funders and things like application forms. how do you communicate there's a kind of a nebulousness about a lot of what you do to start, obviously. How do you turn that into a credible proposition to keep going?
I think it's interesting the way you describe like Dumbworld. I always see Dumbworld as not as a company, but as an artist. And like Dumbworld is an artist, you know. And so we wanted to. In fact, we were probably one of the first artist-led companies, you know, that was able to get support from the Arts Council, and essentially because we are really presenting an idea, you know, we're not facilitating something happening, we're just saying this is what we believe artistically, and this is what we believe about life and people and so on. And so we're driven by a very singular artistic identity, I think, and that I think changes the way that we operate, you know, or changes our priorities in relation to being, say, an arts company or something, you know.
Mm. Would you say that it's hard to categorise what Dumbworld is?
For us, I don't think it is. It's very clear. I mean, we're on a mission to illuminate and create dynamic, intriguing, bewildering art, using as many sort of people, environments, situations, formats that we possibly can. And that's basically, and really with the agenda of, I mean, John will probably, you know, sort of quantify this a little bit, but with the agenda being presenting aspects of humanity about the vulnerability of humans, the destruction of humans, you know, about aspects of what we are as a species. That's essentially what we're trying to pick away at.
Yes, because, yeah, it might be interesting, John, just to give a sense of the the span of the projects that you've done? Because some of them do deal with fairly dark existential questions. human destructiveness is not too far from the surface, and you're dealing with that head on with a whole array of inputs from people who may never normally have felt that they were part of an opera making process. Do you want to say a little bit about the slate of work that you've done, and maybe show some examples?
Yeah, no, it's really broad. I mean, I suppose over the next couple of days here, we have a couple of pieces going up, and we call them street art operas. They're projected films that appear in a wall as if they're a piece of street art, and then they play out as if they are an animated film telling a story. Tomorrow night you'll see Shoot the Fecker and the Pecker, which tells the story of two older women on Zimmer frames chasing after one of the husbands to shoot the fecker and the pecker because he's been sleeping around. But the reason they're doing this is because prison's the only place they can afford these days, you know? It's, at least you get a free meal and doctor's appointments. There you can see the image of one of that. So that's one sort of work that we've been developing over the last couple of years, and that really came from a want to take the work that we were making, and this really is an opera. When you hear this one, that's lyrical voices, big orchestral sound. I'd sing Shoot the Fecker and the Pecker, you know, but go and see it. It sounds a lot better with the voices they have. And the picture you see there, that's another one in the double bill called Two Angels Play, I Spy. And again, it's a lyrical operatic piece. But what we wanted to do and why we call it street art opera is by putting it out into the street. Most people don't actually even realize it's opera. People say, oh, that was a laugh, that was great. That was, you know, and so people accept and watch it in a different way than going into the opera house or into the concert hall. And the sort of span of work, I suppose that's on one end of the work that we're making, and it's very much a collective, because any one of these projects, we're working with designers and video artists and programmers and a whole team of performers who come together with us to collectively make this, and our team who are here today, you know. Rhianne and Claire should be out here, you know, who work very closely with us to develop and produce all of this work. And I suppose on the other end of what we're making, we're engaging with the world and with people and with places. And so there's a number of projects such as The Oldest Woman in Limerick, or if we go back, or Nest. This was a project that we did for the Cultural Olympiad in 2012 with the London Olympics. And so here we had a huge call out around Northern Ireland to collect together thousands of objects that people donated to us with a story that went along with them. And we created a giant exhibition of really social history and the history of the people through these objects, and that the stories of all of these objects then became a song cycle, so that people could come along, visit, read the stories of these objects, and then experience this song cycle that was sung by a choir of about 300 people with the orchestra telling the story in one of the large hangars up in the docks in Belfast. I suppose public space is a really interesting part of what we're trying to do, because it immediately takes what we make and puts it into a really democratic space where you can catch this, see this. This was, again, down in the docks in Belfast, and it was a piece that was inspired by the story of the two sides. I don't know whether you know the docks in Belfast, but obviously on one side you've got the ships, where the ships are built, and the Protestants build the ships, and on the other side you've got the docks and the Gough Squad, and it's the Catholics, and it's the big story of Belfast and the big divide, and thank God that there's a river in the middle, keeps us apart, and you know, that big story that is the story of Belfast. And so by engaging with all of the different communities around that area, we created this piece which sings their song, and that you can go down and watch this video and then sink in to the song of those people singing.
And John, is is the future always going to be outdoor spaces, or will there be virtual spaces and inner worlds as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, at least there's no rain in those virtual spaces, isn't it? You know, that's always the problem here in Ireland. Rain, yeah. You know. Does the virtual space in Ireland, do you get wet there?
Can you work on that?
It's something we have begun to really explore, is that we made a piece for the Royal Opera House called System Failure. And essentially it was an opera within an opera as a website, essentially, as a kind of that you can interact with as a space. So that, and it was really the whole story of that opera was the sort of deconstruction of reality via digital spam and viruses. And so that was the first time we worked in that kind of AI space. But I think, like all of those spaces, like whether it's outside or where it's on a wall or where it's in a theatre or where it's in like a shipyard hangar or where it's in a room or where it's in a little glass box or where it's this size or massive, you know, all of those spaces, I think, are super exciting to explore. You know, like we've done pieces in every conceivable space there is, you know, streets to shopping centres, the shop windows in Germany, and you know, the whole resonance of the space and the thing that you're saying or the work of art is quite an interesting concoction, you know. Mm. So an AI, I think, is just another space to rummage around in. Mm.
Yeah. And when you mention AI, Brian, from your point of view as the composer, I'll come to you in a second, John, from the writing point of view. Is it a neutral space? Is it just a thing, a platform?
I mean, I find the whole business of AI like super, super exciting, you know, in terms of what it does, not just from a compositional point of view or an artist point of view, but how it shifts, I think, our understanding of what art is and what it can be, you know, we're quite fascinated by this idea that, you know, we're so fully committed to the idea that art is a human belonging, it belongs to humans, and that only humans make art. And I'm not sure if I believe that, you know. I love the idea of what art can computers make, you know, do animals make art? All of these ideas about expanding our understanding of what art is, I think AI offers some extraordinarily exciting adventures and working and collaborating with AI to unleash infinite portals of investigation, I think is so exciting, you know.
And are you fairly close to AI now in your own processes and thinking?
More and more, I think, you know, more and more connected to the idea of, I mean, it's funny, like, you know, like I've some composition students, you know, and we have this talk about, you know, music is about trying to express yourself, and I'm not sure if it is. I mean, certainly it can be, but I'm not sure if it is all the time. Sometimes I think it's just about creating something that people have to deal with, you know. Here it is. I'm not trying to express anything, but here it is. Work with that and see how that affects you. And I love that whole idea of, you know, composition about the collecting of things, you know, the reimagining of things, rather than, let me tell you what's in my heart, you know.
So you're obviously open to the idea of works being created, composed, devised, whatever the word is, with virtually no human or no human input at all. That's something that is going to happen.
I think, you know, I think you can't avoid the human input. It's impossible because, like, I mean, those things have to be designed. You know, they have to be switched on. I'm totally excited by the idea of getting out of the way of how things are made, you know. And I often think that it's the key in many ways to a lot of great music and a lot of understanding of what sound is getting out of the way of it. In fact, it's like a John Cage philosophy. It's already happening. Just get out of the way of it and pay attention to it. And I think that same essence of how people think of sound and music and this vast sea of ever-evolving sonicness that we swim around in every day, I love the idea that AI can be part of that and can present something completely new or something, you know, fresh.
John, from your perspective.
You know, it's interesting. It's funny. I'm just looking at this piece here and thinking that in a way, that's a product. It's a thing, you know, that we build. But whenever I think about when we make things, and I hear I'm taking things very much from the position of as a maker of things, you know, as opposed to what we all are as well. You know, we consume and we watch and we listen, you know, and whenever we start making the art, we set off on a process that is the art, you know, and there's a journey, and at some point it sort of becomes a product that other people are looking at. And I suppose that in terms of creating product, there's an efficiency that definitely comes with AI, and that, you know, that we were writing songs with AI on the way down in the car, you know, just to speed up some things that need to be delivered, you know, and that's totally fine. But whenever I think about the processes that are such a key part of what we're doing, sometimes the efficiency isn't what you're looking for at all. You know, the thing that you're looking for is not the product. The thing that you want to experience at that moment, and that you want to whenever you are with other human beings or other non-human beings, you know, we were exploring the possibility of how do you collaborate in a with animals to create a genuine, you know, piece of art. How can you do that? We don't know, but you know, it's a journey that we went on. And again, there you're searching for something else. So it does.
Could you say a wee bit about what that means? What did you do? What does that mean?
See, I'm not sure what it means, you know, because whenever we were, you know, so we were exploring an idea of, you know, how we would collaborate with animals to create work. And this has been done across Europe. You know, Rimini Protocol did a beautiful piece where they were working with an octopus. And so they created a piece of theater with an octopus and a contemporary dancer. Now that brings in so many different questions of our consciousness. It brings up questions of who's in control, who's the artist, what is the art? But all of those are really brilliant questions to go into. And in the end, whenever these different elements sit on stage, for example, together and are moving together, something that is constructed and thought through by me, human being, and something that has a mystery but is moving and is attractive and is engaging, what does that mean? And is that, so again, it comes back to the process. It seems like the exploration that we're going through, and I think all artists do in some way, you know, go through. Once you step out of that singular idea of the single artist making the single piece of work, you know, which none of us really do, you know, there's always, it becomes more complicated and more about the journey.
And do you see any considerable risks with AI, or do you pay any attention to people saying, God, this is the end of it, or there'll be no more writers, there'll be no more players? Do you buy that?
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I could. Whenever people talk about it, you can totally imagine. You know, we've all seen the science fiction, you know, that leads us into that. But it is a sort of a decision about where we want to place ourselves. You know, as humans and the experiences that we want to have. I suppose AI is keenly important, I suppose, for us as artists and as consumers, if we do continue along a line of digital consumption, and that the art that we want to listen to, watch, engage with is digital. But I suppose it's interesting being here, you know, and looking forward to go and see the concerts happening this evening, you know, where obviously digital elements are within it, and I'm sure embedded within the technology or writing of a number of the artists tonight, that's being used. But we're all here for another reason, and another reason that's deeply human.
And I mean, is there a dark other side possible there as well? If you look at the potential implications for the income of artists, if AI is the composer and publisher and the recipient of the royalties, what are we all going to do?
Personally, I don't see the threat about that at all. I think that's the kind of those fears have been in existence since somebody first devised a MIDI program, like, you know, 60 odd years ago or something. You know, the world changes, people's function within the world changes, artists change, people change, you know, the landscape changes, AI is part of that landscape, it changes, you know. I mean, I do think that in terms of the way that we consume music is, at the minute, is like perhaps music is becoming more of, let's say, a digital utility. You know, it's a bit more like water where you turn on the tap and you expect it to be there, and the whole streaming aspect of music is a big thing. But yet it still changes. Still people make music in different ways and so on. And I found the whole, you know, even if you look at, say, even the developments of computer technology and digital audio workstations and, you know, notational programs for music, how that has led to so much new music and how it's sped up people's thinking, created opportunities. I mean, I just, earlier in the year, I did this project where I was working with like 8 9-year-olds and who had really no great in-depth knowledge of music, had maybe just started learning to play instruments. And within about, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, they had all written these massive orchestral works, and they had a notion about what it was they were doing, but they were brilliant. They were brilliant pieces of work. And, you know, you had to get someone at the end to go, well, clarinet can't play that note. They can't play that now, but that's just like tweaking, you know, but just showing them the technology, and they hadn't a notion about what notation was, or what, you know, what the difference between a crotchet and a minim was. It was just like stuff. Put that stuff there and jiggle it around a bit, and there you go.
I mean, it's very, very inspiring to hear that at a time when music education has been stripped out, say in Northern Ireland, for example, and when arts and humanities are under increasing pressure in the education system. It doesn't sound like there's a rebalancing going on in any way, but there's still these remarkably hopeful examples.
Yeah, and that's because of technology. That's because of the mechanisms that allow people to go into the room to play with the toys, you know. And for centuries, you know, something like classical music, I mean, you couldn't even get in the room unless you knew all the stuff that you needed to do, needed to know, you know, what's that note, what's that chord. But now technology allows people to get in the room and start assembling and playing. And you don't need to know what that thing is there. You just need to know that I can move that and put it there and stuff, you know. And I think it's so brilliant. It's so exciting, you know, that, you know, people are not restricted by, you know, their own perceived ability. That you can bypass all that and immediately be in the playground, you know. And that's what technology and what AI does, you know.
And that leads us very nicely in the last couple of minutes. Maybe if you could say a wee word about how technology will let the people get on the street for the for the Scorched Earth trilogy. Do you want to just tell people about that and what they need to do?
Yeah, no, totally. So tonight you have on the main road, you'll have the Scorched Earth trilogy, which is a trilogy of works that we've, three short operas that we've created. They're projected onto a wall, so you'll be able to see them from the street. We've also, just beside Lord Baker's, there you go. In order to listen to them, there's a little app that you can download, which means that with your own phone, you'll be able to sync into a really beautiful, and we've developed this app ourselves to ensure that it's got a brilliant sound quality to it. So if you download the app, you'll be able to sync into the three pieces that are happening tonight, and tomorrow night it's Shoot the Fecker and the Pecker, and you have two angels say, play I Spy.
Do you want to give a little hint of what the other two are about? You've told about Shoot the Fecker and the Pecker. What about the other two?
The trilogy, the Scorched Earth trilogy is a trilogy of three operas that are really a resonance to what's happening in the world today. So they deal with kind of environmental issues. Just very briefly, the first one is about four politicians who are celebrating the fact that they have achieved this agreement. And they're also pleased with themselves that they decide to have a pissing competition up against a wall. And eventually,
we're classy, you can think opera.
Who can piss the highest? And of course, what happens is the whole world fills up with their piss, and eventually these little boats start to appear on the sea of piss, trying to get this on our place. And then the second one is a father and daughter polar bear, who are struggling to find food in their natural habitat, so they start to come into towns and rummage through bins to find food because their natural source of food has been threatened by climate change. And the daughter eventually persuades the father that the only way they can actually survive is to start making TikToks. So she starts to tell her how to make TikTok videos. And the third one is a little more reflective in the sense that it's a group of children who are living in this kind of black and white dystopian sort of landscape. And they basically just look at you and sing about how important it is to invest in this notion of revival, invest in the growth of the planet. And as they sing to you, they move from this black and white world to this kind of extraordinarily colourful world full of growth and colour and hope and beauty. So that's it. There are three back-to-back, yeah.
Ray Nervine, John McElduff, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Brian Irvine and John McElduff for joining Dermot in Dingle. On next week's episode, I speak with award-winning writer Mark O'Connell and tech founder Mark Little about the big picture of the AI revolution. To make sure you don't miss that or any of our future episodes, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Southwind Blows production, and I'm Christopher Kassan. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to your company next time on Ireland's Edge.